The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 5, Side 1.
But that is not all. There is one more important feature of our public life which helps thieves and bandits prosper. Fear of publicity. Our newspapers are filled with reports on production victories which are a big bore to everyone, but you will find no reports of trials or crime in them. After all, according to the progressive doctrine, criminal activity arises only from the presence of classes. We have no classes in our country, therefore there is no crime, and therefore you cannot write about it in the press. We simply cannot afford to give the American newspapers evidence that we have not fallen behind the United States in criminal activity. If there is a murder in the West, photographs of the criminal are plastered on the walls of buildings. They peer out at one from the counters of bars, the windows of streetcars, and the criminal feels himself a persecuted rat. If a brazen murder is committed here, the press is silent, there are no photographs, the murderer goes 60 miles away to another province, and lives there in peace and quiet. And the Minister of Internal Affairs will not have to answer questions in Parliament as to why the criminal has not been found. After all, no one knows about the case except the inhabitants of that little town. If they find him, well and good. If not, that is all right too. The murderer hasn't violated the state border, so he isn't dangerous enough to the state, to justify proclaiming a countrywide search for him. It was the same with criminal activity as it was with malaria. It was simply announced one day that it no longer existed in our country, and from then on it became impossible to treat it or even to diagnose it. Of course, both the police and the courts were inclined to close cases, but that led to formalities which played even more into the hands of the real murderers and bandits. They would accuse anyone at all of an unsolved case, whoever happened to be nearest at hand, and they were particularly fond of hanging several crimes on someone already guilty of one. It is worthwhile recalling here the case of Pyotr Kidzilov, who was twice, without any clues or evidence, sentenced to be shot for a murder he had not committed. Or the case of Alexeyentsev, which was similar. If lawyer Popov's letter about the Kidzilov case had come not to Izvestia but to the Times, it would have resulted in a change of the Queen's judge or a government crisis. But in our country, 4 months later, the Provincial Party Committee, why the Provincial Party Committee was the court subordinate to it, met, and taking into consideration the youth and lack of experience of the investigator, why do they entrust people's faith to such people? And his participation in the war of the fatherland, for some reason they didn't take it into consideration with us in our time, entered an official reprimand in one person's record and wagged a threatening finger at somebody else. And for using torture, this being already after the 20th Congress, the chief executioner Yakovenko was allegedly sentenced to 3 years, a full half year later, but since he was one of our own and was acting on instructions, carrying out orders from above, is it likely that he was actually compelled to serve his sentence? Such vindictiveness! But defense lawyer Popov, for example, had to be dealt with and driven out of Belgorod. He should learn the thieves, the countrywide principle. If they're not beating you, then don't lie down and ask for it. And so it is that anyone who speaks out on behalf of justice comes to repent thrice over, 8 times over, that he ever did so. This is how the system of punishment is turned around so as to be an encouragement to thieves. And for decades they flourished like an unruly mould on our freedom, and in prisons and in camps. And there is always that sanctifying lofty theory for everything. It was by no means the least significant of our literary figures who determined that the thieves were our allies in the building of communism. This was set forth in textbooks on Soviet corrective labor policy. There were such textbooks. They were published. In dissertations and scientific essays on camp management. And in the most practical way of all, in the regulations on which the high-ranking camp officials were trained. All this flowed from the one and only true teaching, which explained all the iridescent life of humanity in terms of the class struggle and it alone. And here is how it was worked out. Professional criminals can in no sense be equated with capitalist elements, that is, engineers, students, agronomists, and nuns, for the latter are steadfastly hostile to the dictatorship of the proletariat, while the former are only politically unstable. A professional murderer is only politically unstable. The lumpen proletarian is not a property owner and therefore cannot ally himself with the hostile class elements, but will much more willingly ally himself with the proletariat. You just wait. That is why, in the official terminology of Gulag, they are called socially friendly elements. Tell me who your friends are. That is why the regulations repeated over and over again, trust the recidivist criminals. That is why, through the cultural and educational section, a consistent effort was supposed to be made to explain to the thieves the unity of their class interests with those of all the workers, to indoctrinate them in a suspicious and hostile attitude toward the kulaks and counter-revolutionaries. And the authorities were to place their hopes in these attitudes. Remember Averbach, he taught you to steal. You never would have stolen on your own. And remember, fan the class struggle in the camps. The packed-up thief, G. Minayev, wrote me a letter in the Literaturnaya Gazeta. Zavyazat, to knot up one's bag equals to pack up, was thieves' jargon for leaving the thieves' law with the consent of the underworld to join the life of the suckers. The letter was dated November the 29th, 1962. I was even proud that although a thief, I was not a traitor and betrayer. On every convenient occasion they tried to teach us thieves that we were not lost to our motherland, that even if we were profligate sons, we were nonetheless sons. But there was no place for the fascists on this earth. And the theory also held that it was necessary to study and make use of the best traits of the thieves. They loved romanticism. So the orders of the camp chiefs must be enveloped in an aura of romanticism. They strove toward heroism. Give them the heroism of work, if they would accept it. They had an adventurous spirit. Give them the adventure of competition. Those who know both the camps and the thieves find it hard to believe that all this was not written by imbeciles. Were they conceited? Did they like to be the center of attention? Play up to their conceit with praise, with honors. Promote them into positions of leadership, particularly the ringleaders, so as to employ their already established authority among the thieves for the purposes of the camp. That is exactly what it says in Averbach's monograph, The Authority of the Ringleaders. But when this elegant theory came down to earth in camps, here is what emerged from it. The most inveterate and hardened thieves were given unbridled power on the islands of the archipelago, in camp districts, and in camps. Power over the population of their own country, over the peasants, the petty bourgeoisie, and the intelligentsia. Power they had never before had in history, never in any state in all the world. Power which they couldn't even dream of out in freedom. And now they were given all other people as slaves. What bandit would ever decline such power? The central thieves, the top-level thieves, totally controlled the camp districts. They lived in individual cabins or tents with their own temporary wives, or arbitrarily picking over the smooth broads from among their subjects. They had the intellectual women 58s and the girl students to vary their menu. In Norilag, Shavdarov heard a moll offer her thief husband, "Would you like me to treat you to a 16-year-old collective farm girl?" This was a peasant girl who had been sent to the north for 10 years because of 1 kilo of grain. The girl tried to resist, but the moll soon broke her will. "I'll cut you up. Do you think I'm any worse than you? I lie under him?" And they had their own lackeys, too, servants from among the sloggers who carried out their chamber pots. They had their food prepared separately, using the little bit of meat and good fat issued for the common pot. The thieves who were one rank lower carried out the managerial tasks of the work assigners, the deputies for auxiliary services, and the commandants, and in the morning they used to stand in pairs with clubs at the exits from the tents for two and command, "Leave without the last one." The lesser hoodlums were used to beat up the work shirkers, that is, those who no longer had the strength left to drag themselves to work. The chief of Tyanmir Peninsula used to drive up to the line-up in his sedan and admire the way the thieves beat up the 58s. Lastly, the thieves who were able to chirp, in other words, to talk glibly, washed the dirt off their necks and were appointed instructors. They gave speeches, lectured the 58s on how to live, themselves lived on what they stole, and got time-off sentence. On the Bellamore Canal, an ugly mug like that, an instructor from among the socially friendly, who understood nothing about the business of construction, could abrogate the construction orders of a socially hostile construction supervisor. And this was not only a question of theory translated into practice, but also of the harmony of everyday life. It was better for the thieves that way, and it was quieter and easier for the chiefs that way, not to tire their arms with beatings, or their throats, not to get involved in details, and even not to appear in the camp compound. And it was much better for the business of oppression. The thieves carried it out much more brazenly, much more brutally, and without the least fear of responsibility before the law. But even in places where the thieves were not given such power, they were all, on the basis of this same class theory, very much favoured. If the thieves left the camp compound, that was the biggest sacrifice that could be asked of them. At work, they could lie about as much as they pleased, smoke, tell their stories of victories, escapes, heroism, and warm themselves in the sun in summer and at the bonfire in winter. Their bonfires were never touched by the guards, but the bonfires of the 58s were scattered and stamped out. But the cubes, the cubic yards, of timber, earth, or coal, were then stolen from the 58s. The custom of living off someone else's cubage, work output, is maintained by the thief after he is released too, even though at first glance this would contradict his adherence to socialism. In 1951, at Oymyakon, Ustnera, the thief Krokalyov was freed and took on a job as a coal miner at that same mine. He never even lifted a sledge, but the mine foreman recorded a record output for him by stealing from the Zeks. Krokalyov received from 8 to 9,000 rubles per month, and he brought the Zeks 1,000 rubles worth of food to Bolt, and they were glad enough of this and kept their mouths shut. In 1953, the brigadier, a prisoner, Milyuchikin, tried to break up this system. The free thieves cut him up, and he was charged with robbery. He was tried and got a renewal of his 20 years. Now, this note should not be understood as an amendment of the Marxist thesis that the lumpen proletarian is not a property owner. Of course he isn't. Krokalyov didn't use his 8,000 to build himself a private house. He lost them at cards, drank them, or spent them on the broads. And in addition, they even took thieves to the rallies of shock workers, which on the whole were rallies of the recidivists, Dimitlag, and the Bellamore Canal. Now here is one female thief, Beregovaya. She got herself into the glorious chronicles of the Moscow-Volga Canal. She was the scourge of every jail she was ever in, and raised hell in every police station. If she ever had a whim to do some work, she immediately destroyed whatever she had done. With her necklace of sentences, she had been sent to Dmitlag in July 1933. The chapter of legends continues. She went into the India barracks, and, to her astonishment, and the only thing believable is that astonishment, heard no mother oaths and saw no card games. They were supposed to have explained to her that the thieves there enjoyed their work. And she immediately went off to the excavations and even began to work well. Read this to mean that they credited her with the cubic yards of other people. Just look at that face. And then comes the chapter of truth. In October, when it got cold, she went to the physician, and even though she was not ill, she asked him, with a knife up her sleeve, for several days off. The physician willingly agreed. He always had many places available. And the work assigner was an old girlfriend of Beregovaya named Polyakova, and on her own account she added 2 weeks of loafing by setting up fake work days for her. More cubic yards were stolen from the sluggers. And right then and there, seeing the enviable life of a work assigner, Beregovaya decided she would like to become a bitch, too. And that very day, when Polyakova wakened her to go out to line up, Beregovaya declared she would not go out to dig dirt before she had exposed Polyakova's machinations with work days, output, and rations. She was not particularly held back by any feeling of gratitude. She managed to get called in to see the security officer. The thieves were not afraid of the security officers, because no second term threatened them, but just let some KR women try to avoid going out to work. And right away she became a brigadier of the lagging men's brigade. Evidently she had promised to kick in the teeth of these last leggers. And then a work assigner in Polyakova's place, and then an instructor in the women's barracks. This expert in oaths, this card shark, this thief. And then chief of a construction detachment. She was already ordering engineers around. And all the red bulletin boards of Dmitlag displayed this toothy bitch smiling there, in a leather jacket and with a field pouch, filched from someone. Those hands of hers were skilled at beating men. The eyes of those of a witch. This woman was praised by Averbach. So easy were the paths of the thieves in camp. A bit of scandal, a bit of betrayal, and from there on, beat and stomp. People will object that it was only the bitches who accepted positions, while the honest thieves held to the thieves' law. But no matter how much I saw of one and the other, I never could see that one rabble was nobler than the other. The thieves knocked gold teeth out of Estonians' mouths with a poker. The thieves, in Kraslag in 1941, drowned Lithuanians in the toilet for refusing to turn over a food parcel to them. The thieves used to plunder prisoners sentenced to death. Thieves would jokingly kill the first cellmate who came their way just to get a new interrogation and trial and spend the winter in a warm place or to get out of a hard camp into which they had fallen. So why mention such petty details as stripping the clothes or shoes from someone out in sub-zero temperatures? And why mention stolen rations? No, you'll not get fruit from a stone, nor good from a thief. The theoreticians of Gulag were indignant. The kulaks, in camp, didn't even regard the thieves as real people, thereby, so to speak, betraying their true bestial colours. But how can you regard them as people if they tear your heart out of your body and suck on it? All their romantic bravado is the bravado of vampires. People in educated circles who have not themselves encountered thieves on their narrow path may object to such a merciless estimate of the thieves' world. Was it not a secret love of private property that motivated those whom the thieves so irked? I insist on my own expression, vampires sucking your heart. They defile absolutely everything that for us pertains to the natural sphere of humanity. But is it really so hopeless? After all, the thieves are not born with these traits. But where is the good side of their hearts? I don't know. Probably it has been killed and suppressed by the thieves' law, in accordance with which the rest of us are not people. We have already written about the threshold of evil-doing. Evidently, the thief who has absorbed the thieves' law has irreversibly crossed some moral threshold. People will also object. But you saw only the petty thieves. The important real thieves, the big shots of the thieves' world, were all shot in 1937. And in truth, I did not see the thieves of the 20s, but I simply do not have imagination enough to picture them as moral beings. But enough. Let us say a word in defense of the thieves also. They had their own original code and their own original concept of honor. But it was not a question of their being patriots, as our bureaucrats and writers would have liked to have it, but of their being absolutely consistent materialists and consistent pirates. And even though the dictatorship of the proletariat was so assiduous in courting them, they did not respect it, even for one minute. This tribe came into this world to live, and since they were destined to spend as much time in prison as in freedom, then they wanted to gather life's flowers in prison too. And what did they care about, the purpose for which the prison was planned, or the suffering of others beside them there? They were unruly, and they enjoyed the fruits of that unruliness there, so why should they worry about the man who bowed his head and died a slave? They had to eat, so they took whatever they could see that was edible and tasty. They had to drink, so they sold the convoy guards the things they had taken from their neighbors for vodka. They had to sleep on something soft, and despite their manly looks, it was considered quite honorable for them to carry their own pillow with them, as well as a padded blanket or feather quilt. The more so because one could hide a knife in it very well. They loved the rays of the beneficent sun, and if they couldn't take a trip to a Black Sea resort, they tanned themselves on the roofs of their construction projects, in the stone quarries, at the mine entrances. Let someone stupider go down into the mines. They had magnificent, well-fed muscles, bunched in rippling knots. They surrendered their bronze skin to tattooing, and in this way gradually satisfied their artistic, their erotic, even their moral needs. On one another's chests, stomachs, and backs, they could admire powerful eagles perched on cliffs or flying through the sky. Or the big hammer, the sun, with its rays shooting out in every direction. Or women and men copulating. Or the individual organs of their sexual enjoyment. And all of a sudden, next to their hearts, were Lenin or Stalin, or perhaps both. And this meant exactly the same as the crucifix around a thief's neck. Sometimes they would laugh at a droll stoker hurling coal into their rear orifice, or a monkey engaged in masturbation. And they would read slogans on each other, which, even if they were already familiar, they nonetheless dearly loved to repeat. Blank all the girls in the mouth. And it sounded as triumphant as, "I am King Asargodan." Or else, on a girl thief's stomach, there might be, "I will die for a hot blank." And even the modest and tiny moral on an arm which had already buried a dozen knives in somebody's ribs, "Remember your mother's words." Or else, "I remember caresses, I remember my mother." The thieves had a mother cult, a formality, however, which did not mean faithfulness to her teachings. In order to intensify their sensations in their swift-running lives, they used to love taking drugs. The easiest drug to get was anusha, marijuana, from hemp. It was also known among them as planchik, and was rolled into a smoke. They even used to sing about it gratefully in their songs. "Planchik, planchik, God's grass tall, joy of pickpockets, one and all." Yes, they do not recognize the earthly institution of private property, and in this respect they really are hostile to the bourgeoisie and to those communists who have dachas and automobiles. Everything they come across on life's path they take as their own, if it is not too dangerous. Even when they have a surfeit of everything, they reach out to grab what belongs to others, because any unstolen article makes a thief sick at heart. They wear the clothes they have stolen while they have novelty, until they tire of them, and soon afterward lose them at cards. Card games that last for several nights on end give them their most powerful sensations, and in this respect they have far outdone the Russian nobility of past eras. They can even gamble an eye for stakes, and tear out the loser's eye on the spot. And they can also play for beneath themselves, the stakes being the right to use the loser for perverted enjoyment. And when they lose, they declare a general frisking on a barge or in a barracks, until they find something else belonging to one of the suckers, and then the game goes on. The thieves don't like to work, and why should they, when they get food, drink, and clothing without it? Of course, this constitutes a barrier between them and the working class. But does the working class love work that much either? Isn't it for the bitter money that the working class strains its sinews, having no other way to earn it? Not only can the thieves not be carried away by their enthusiasm for labor, but labor is repulsive to them, and they know how to express this dramatically. For example, if they are sent off on an agricultural work party and forced to leave the camp compound in order to rake up vetch and oats for forage, they don't simply sit down and rest, but they gather all the rakes and forks in a heap and set fire to them, and then warm themselves at the bonfire. Socially hostile foremen, make a decision. When they tried to compel them to fight for their motherland, it was useless. Their motherland is the whole earth, The conscripted thieves went off in transport, singing their song as they swayed back and forth. Our cause is right. Our cause is left. Why is everyone on the lam? Why, indeed? And then they would steal something, get themselves arrested, and take a familiar prisoner transport back to prison in the rear. Even the surviving Trotskyites applied from camp to be allowed to serve at the front. The thieves did not make any such applications. But when the operational armies began to surge into Europe, and the smell of booty grew strong, they put on uniforms and went off to plunder at the heels of the army. They jokingly called themselves the Fifth Ukrainian Front. But, and in this too they were much more principled than the 58s, no Zhenga Zhurgol or Vaska Kishkenya, with rolled down boot tops, respectfully pronouncing that sacred word thief with a one-sided grimace, would ever be caught helping to strengthen the prison, digging in posts, stringing barbed wire, trenching the no-man's land at the camp perimeter, repairing the gatehouse, fixing the perimeter lighting. In this lay the thief's honor. Prison had been created as the enemy of his freedom, and he could not work for prison. However, he did not run any risk of getting Article 58 for refusing to work, whereas the poor enemy of the people would immediately have had counter-revolutionary sabotage hung on him. The thieves were bold and impudent because of their own impunity, for, as the saying goes, whoever has been mauled by a bear is likely to be afraid of a stump. It was totally out of the question to see a thief with a newspaper. The thieves held firm to their belief that politics was twaddle, without relation to real life. Neither did they read books, or at least only very rarely. But they loved oral literature, and any storyteller who could endlessly string out novels for them after curfew would always be well fed out of their booty and held in esteem by them, as are all storytellers and singers among primitive peoples. These novels were a fanciful and rather monotonous amalgam of dime novels about life in high society, obligatorily high society, peopled with titled viscounts, counts, and marquises, and with their own thieves' legends, their own self-magnification, their own thieves' jargon, and their thieves' concepts of the luxurious life which the hero always had to achieve in the end. The countess would lie down on his cot. He would smoke only the very best Kazbek, would own an onion, a watch, and his prokhorva, his boots, would be shined to a high gloss. Nikolai Pogodin was sent on an official visit to the Belomor Canal, and probably used up no small amount of Soviet government money. Yet he didn't see through the thieves, didn't understand them, and told lies about everything. Since in our literature nothing has been written about the camps for 40 years except Pogodin's play and the subsequent film, we have to comment on it. The wretchedness of the KR engineers who stared into the mouths of their instructors and thereby learned how to live does not even require comment. But his aristocrats, his thieves, do. Pogodin even contrived not to notice in them their simple characteristic of robbing by the right of the strong, not secretly like a pickpocket. He portrayed them all to a man as petty pickpockets, and more than a dozen times he points this up in the play to the point of nausea, and he has the thieves steal from the thieves. Utter nonsense, they steal only from the suckers and turn everything over to their ringleader. Neither did Pogodin understand, or he did not wish to understand, the real stimuli of camp work, hunger, beatings, and the collective responsibility of the brigade. He did not even distinguish between the camp inmate who was a comrade and the one who was a citizen. He latched on to only one thing, the socially friendly character of the thieves, which he was prompted to by the canal administration in Medvezhegorsk, and even before that by Gorky in Moscow. And he rushed to show the reforging of the thieves, and what came out was such an outrageous libel of the thieves that even I want to defend them against it. They are much smarter than Pogodin shows them, or Shenin either. And you couldn't buy them with some kind of cheap reforging, simply because their world outlook was closer to real life than that of the prison chiefs. It was more integrated and contained no elements of idealism whatever. Yet all those incantations to starving people to work and die at work, pure idealism. And if in speaking to a citizen chief or a correspondent from Moscow, or at an absurd meeting, there appeared a tear in their eye and a tremor in their voice. That was because they were playing a well-calculated role aimed at getting them privileges or time-off sentence. And inside himself, meanwhile, the thief was laughing the whole time. The thieves understood the joke very well indeed, but the visiting writers from the capital didn't. It was impossible for the bitch, Mitya, to enter the cell of a strict regiment company unarmed, without a jailer, and for the local thief ringleader, Kostya, to crawl beneath the bunks to hide from him. Kostya, of course, had a knife ready, and if he hadn't, he would have hurled himself on Mitya to choke him, and one of the two would have been dead. Now, that was no joke, just the opposite. But Pogodin creates a banal joke, the horrifying hypocrisy of the re-education of Sonya. Why? What forced her to take up a wheelbarrow? And through her, Kostya, too? And the two thieves becoming guards? The non-political offenders could have done that, but not thieves. And all that competition between brigades was quite out of the question for the cynical, sober thieves, except maybe for the sake of laughs at the free workers. And the most irritatingly false note of all was the thieves asking to be given the rules for creating a commune. It would have been impossible to slander the thieves more or to make them more stupid. The thieves asking for rules? The thieves knew their own rules perfectly well, from the first robbery to the last knife blow in the neck. When you could beat a person who was down on the ground, and when five could attack one, and when they could attack a person who was sleeping. And for their own commune, they had rules which predated the Communist Manifesto. Their commune, more precisely their world, was a separate world within our world, and the strict laws which for centuries had existed in it for strengthening that world did not in any degree depend on our suckers' legislation, or even on the party congresses. They had their own laws of seniority, by which their ringleaders were not elected at all. Yet when they entered a cell or a camp compound, already wore their crown of power, and were immediately recognized as chiefs. These ringleaders might have strong intellectual capacities, and always had a clear comprehension of the thieves' philosophy, as well as a sufficient number of murders and robberies behind them. The thieves had their own courts, pravilki, founded on the code of thieves' honor and tradition. The sentences of the court were merciless and were executed implacably, even if the condemned person was quite out of reach and in a completely different camp compound. The types of punishment inflicted were unusual. They might all jump in turn from the upper bunks on to a convicted person lying on the floor and thus break his ribcage. And what did their word frayersky, of the suckers, mean? It meant what was universally human, what pertained to all normal people. And it was precisely this universally human world, our world, with its morals, customs, and mutual relationships, which was most hateful to the thieves, most subject to their ridicule, counterposed most sharply to their own antisocial, antipublic kubla, or clan. No, it was not re-education which began to break the back of the thieves' world. The re-education merely helped them return faster to new robberies. It was when, in the 50s, brushing off class theory and social friendliness, Stalin gave orders that the thieves be incarcerated in isolators, in solitary long-term cells, and even that new prisons be built for them, the shut-ups, as the thieves called them. In these shut-ups, or isolators, the thieves swiftly wilted, sickened, and began to die. Because a parasite cannot live in isolation by itself, it has to live on somebody, twining itself around the victim. Chapter 17. The Kids. The archipelago had many ugly mugs and many bared fangs. No matter what side you approached it from, there wasn't one you could admire. But perhaps the most abominable of all was that maw that swallowed up the kids. The kids were not at all those bespridzorniki, or waifs in drab tatters who scurried hither and thither, thieving and warming themselves at asphalt cauldrons on the streets, without whom one could not picture the urban life of the 20s. The waifs were taken from the streets, not from their families, into the colonies for juvenile delinquents. There was one attached to the People's Commissariat of Education as early as 1920. It would be interesting to know, too, how things went with juvenile offenders before the revolution. Into workhouses for juveniles, which existed from 1921 to 1930 and had bars, bolts, and jailers, so that in the outworn bourgeois terminology, they could have been called prisons. And also into the labor communes of the Ogpu from 1924 on. They had been orphaned by the Civil War, by its famine, by social disorganization, the execution of their parents, or the death of the latter at the front. And at that time, justice really did try to return these children to the mainstream of life, removing them from their street apprenticeship as thieves. Factory apprenticeship began in the labor communes, and this was a privileged situation in the context of those years of unemployment, and many of the lads there learned with a will. From 1930 on, for sentenced juveniles, factory apprenticeship schools of a special type were created under the People's Commissariat of Justice. The young offenders had to work from 4 to 6 hours a day, for which they received wages on the basis of the All-Union Code of Labour Laws. And for the rest of their day, they studied and played, and perhaps things might have been set to rights on this path. But where did the young offenders come from? They came from Article 12 of the Criminal Code of 1926, which permitted children from the age of 12 to be sentenced for theft, assault, mutilation, and murder. Article 58 offences were also included under this heading. But they had to be given moderate sentences, not the whole works, like adults. Here was the first crawl hole into the archipelago for the future kids, but it was not yet a wide gate. We are not going to omit one interesting statistic. In 1927, prisoners aged 16, they didn't count the younger ones, to 24, represented 48% of all prisoners. What this amounts to is that nearly half the entire archipelago in 1927 consisted of youths whom the October Revolution had caught between the ages of 6 and 14. 10 years after the victorious revolution, these same girls and boys turned up in prison and constituted half the prison population. This jibes poorly with the struggle against the vestiges of bourgeois consciousness which we inherited from the old society, but figures are figures. They demonstrate that the archipelago never was short of young people. But the question of how young was decided in 1935. In that year, the great evildoer once more left his thumbprint on history's submissive clay. Among such deeds as the destruction of Leningrad and the destruction of his own party, he did not overlook the children whom he loved so well, whose best friend he was, and with whom he therefore had his photograph taken. Seeing no other way to bridle those insidious mischief-makers, those washerwomen's brats, who were overrunning the country in thicker and thicker swarms and growing more and more brazen in their violations of socialist legality, he invented a gift for them. These children from 12 years of age, by this time his beloved daughter was approaching that borderline, and he could see that age tangibly before his eyes, should be sentenced to the whole works in the code. In other words, with the application of all measures of punishment, as the decree of the Central Executive Committee and the Council of People's Commissars of April 7, 1935, elucidated, including, that is, capital punishment as well. Illiterates that we scrutinized decrees very little at the time. More and more we gazed at the portraits of Stalin with a black-haired little girl in his arms. Even less did the 12-year-olds read the decrees, and the decrees kept coming out one after another. On December the 10th, 1940, the sentencing of juveniles from the age of 12 for putting various objects on railroad tracks. This was training young diversionists. On May the 31st, 1941, it was decreed that for all other varieties of crime not included in Article 12, juveniles were to be given full sentences from the age of 14 on. But here, a small obstacle arose. The war of the fatherland began. But the law is the law, and on July the 7th, 1941, 4 days after Stalin's panicky speech in the days when German tanks were driving toward Leningrad, Smolensk, and Kiev, one more decree of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet was issued, and it is difficult now to say in what respect it is more interesting for us today, in its unwavering academic character, showing what important questions were being decided by the government in those flaming days, or in its actual contents. The situation was that the prosecutor of the USSR, Vyshinsky, had complained to the Supreme Soviet about the Supreme Court, which means His Graciousness had heard about the matter, because the courts were applying the decree of 1935 incorrectly, and these brats were being sentenced only when they had intentionally committed crimes. But this was impermissible softness. And so, right in the heat of war, the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet elucidated, "This interpretation does not correspond to the text of the law. It introduces limitations not provided for by the law." And in agreement with the prosecutor, the Presidium issued a clarification to the Supreme Court. "Children must be sentenced and the full measure of punishment applied," in other words, the whole works, "even in cases where crimes were committed not intentionally, but as a result of carelessness." Now that is something. Perhaps in all world history, no one has yet approached such a radical solution of the problem of children, from 12 years on for carelessness, up to and including execution. In March 1972, all England was shocked when in Turkey a 14-year-old adolescent was sentenced to 6 years for dealing in large amounts of narcotics. How could it be? And where were the hearts and eyes of your leftist leaders when they read the Stalinist laws on kids? And that is when all the escape holes were shut off to the greedy mice. That is when finally all the collective farm ears of grain were saved. And now the granaries were going to be filled to overflowing and life would flourish, and children who had been bad from birth would be set on the long path of correction. And none of the party prosecutors with children the same age shuddered. They found no problem in stamping the arrest warrants. And none of the party judges shuddered either. With bright eyes they sentenced little children to 3, 5, 8, and 10 years in general camps. And for shearing sheaves, these tykes got not less than 8 years. And for a pocketful of potatoes, one pocketful of potatoes in a child's trousers, they also got 8 years. Cucumbers did not have so high a value put on them. For a dozen cucumbers, Sasha Blokhin got 5 years. And the hungry 14-year-old girl Lida, in the Chingirlau district centre of Kustanai province, walked down the street picking up, mixed with the dust, a narrow trail of grain spilled from a truck, doomed to go to waste in any case. For this, she was sentenced to only 3 years because of the alleviating circumstances that she had not taken socialist property directly from the field or from the barn. And perhaps what also inclined the judges to be less harsh was that in that same year of 1948, there had been a clarification of the Supreme Court to the effect that children need not be tried for theft which had the character of childish mischief, such as the petty theft of apples in an orchard. By analogy, the court drew the conclusion here that it was possible to be just a wee bit less harsh. But the conclusion we draw is that from 1935 to 1948, children were sentenced for taking apples. And a great many were sentenced for running away from factory apprenticeship training. True, they got only 6 months for that. In camp, they were jokingly called death row prisoners. But joke or no joke, here is a scene with some such death row prisoners in a Far Eastern camp. They were assigned to dump the shit from latrines. There was a cart with two enormous wheels and an enormous barrel on it, full of stinking sludge. The death row prisoners were hitched up, with many of them in the shafts and others pushing from the sides and from behind. The barrel kept swaying and splashing them. And the crimson-cheeked bitches in their twill suits roared with laughter as they urged the children on with clubs. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.